All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. It is incredible to have you. We are so excited that you've decided to pull a chair up to the table and join the meeting of the Unknowing Minds. We've got an incredible show tonight, and I think it's going to be a lot of fun for everybody. But we're not gonna waste too much time. I know this one could go a little bit. So without further ado, as always, my name is Matt Ashe, the head cross associate head track and field coach at UAB down in Birmingham, Alabama, the host. We're excited to have you here. So again, thank you for pulling a chair up to the table. Thank you for joining us while you run, while you walk. Maybe you're sitting in the morning, pouring your cup of coffee. You're sitting back at night, trying to get away from the world, and you got a little, you got a nice brew you popped open, or you got a little something on the rocks, a glass of wine, whatever the case might be. Or maybe you're sitting at lunchtime, just enjoying some sweet tea, some water, some juice, whatever the case might be. We do thank you for joining us up at the table here. So without further ado, let's jump into it tonight. We've got an incredible, incredible guest. The president of the cross country chapter of the USTF CCCA is joining us tonight. We're going to get to Vicky here in a second here, but as always, joining us from Nevada, Mr. Scott Williamson. How we doing out there, buddy?
Doing well. We had our first snowfall of the year. Got a little snow on the ground. Man. I'm hoping it melts soon, but it was kind of exciting.
I'm not gonna lie. I do love Birmingham's weather. The fact it was 72 today. But I do miss the snow, being the Wisconsinite I am. So let's stay in the snow right now. I know he doesn't have any snow, but you never know what's going on in St. Louis. Mr. John Bell, how we doing, sir?
No snow. It was 80 degrees yesterday, and it was a crisp 55 today. So no snow. I don't miss it. Don't want it. Don't want to see it. But we're good.
You know it's coming.
Yeah, it's going to be here. Yeah, unfortunately.
Man. The one who let's go over to Bloomington, Indiana. Gentleman who hasn't left his house, no matter what the consequences are, he has stayed there. You can see that by the rotation of books. That never happens. But Mr. Mike Erb, how we doing, buddy?
I'm doing real, real well. It was 80 degrees here yesterday as well, and I was always wondering who the guy was that actually missed the snow, because I, after living in Southern California for 5 years, and everybody telling me I would miss the snow, that I could promise you there wasn't a single day that I was wishing there was that white stuff on the ground. But we're enjoying some good weather and looking forward to a good conversation here this evening.
And I do. But the best thing is I miss it if it, like, they take care of it. It's not, you can't put sand down on the roads and expect it to be good, because that ruins it. It's all down, cleared off. Let's go ahead and rock and roll. And then of course, from VCU, as always, a gentleman who does know about snow too, no matter where he lives. But we have Mr. Uncle Tom, Tom Sager with us. How we doing, sir?
Doing well. Yeah, no snow for us out here in Richmond either. 70 degrees, but from a Milwaukee kid, yeah, I don't miss the snow either.
All right. I'm sorry. Sometimes it happens. I mean, that's, as we all know, that's why the Brewers built a dome, so you could actually play in April and it's 40 degrees outside. That was brilliant. First opening day I went to in Miller Park, it was 42 degrees outside and snowing. There was a sleet, snow, rain mixture. And it was 72 inside watching the Brewers play the Dodgers.
Yeah, it's a beautiful facility for sure.
Absolutely. And as of course, we are excited, ecstatic to have President Vicky Mitchell, but the director of track and field and cross country at the University of Buffalo for the past 22 years and has done an incredible job, finishing up her last month as the USTF CCCA president. How are you? How are things in Buffalo?
Well, I would just say snow free. We have not had snow. And yesterday marked the 1 year PTSD flashback to when I was trying to shovel my cross country course.
Yeah.
And failed. And it was 73 yesterday. And I think it was only 66 today. But, you know, typical Buffalo weather. Beautiful. Sunny.
66, you're careful, cold front might be coming through sometime soon. You never know.
Yes, I'm quite sure it will be. Yes, but we have actually had a couple of record highs this week. So it's been unusual, but really enjoyable.
That is awesome. Well, we're all rocking and rolling. And I think one of the nice things everybody gets to rock and roll right now and do is get ready for track and field practice or cross country. I know. Are you guys racing, 10 days conference meet? Am I correct?
Yes. November 21st, Mid-American Conference is now going to have a conference championship.
Man, I'm excited to see this. And it scares me at the same time to see how many conferences are doing it. But at the same time, it does excite me that conferences are actually willing to be able to do it, even if it is one or two meets for a conference schedule.
Right. And for us, you know, as schools that are basically in the north area of the country, the original date they were looking at, March 6th, not so ideal to be able to find, you know, grass to run on. So when the presidents and the ADs voted to bring football in for a shortened season in November to start play, as track and field and cross country coaches, we all got on a Zoom call and discussed, hey, you know, we ought to push or try to get a cross country championship in November when it's feasible to run. Our administrators at the respective schools were on board with that, and the presidents were. So I think for the purposes of logistics, it works out to our favor.
Good. Well, I mean, honestly, cheers to Buffalo and the Mid-American. I'm glad you guys got a conference going, and, you know, I'm glad more conferences are doing it. Honestly, I'm just praying everything goes off well. But I think one thing that's not going off well is every time we turn around, I think this – every time – well, there we go. Apologize. Technology sometimes gets you. But one thing that's not going well for programs left and right, and I think it's going to be scaring us a little bit, and we'll get into Vicky's background and what she's done in the sport and with women's athletics and that kind of stuff here in a second. But one thing we have to hammer, I think, is something we didn't want to talk about again. With some of our guests, we've talked about it with – the CEO, Sam Seams. We've talked about it with Gary Wilson. We've had different people in general hit on this. And again, if I'm referring to it, and if you haven't seen it yet, go start looking it up. Clemson cut their men's cross country and track and field programs this year, the University of Clemson. And some numbers are being thrown around right now. One of the numbers we've seen, of course, and I don't know how I can do this and think about this, because I've always been told, don't compare yourself to football and basketball if you're cross country and track. Don't do it. It's not smart. You're not playing in the same playground at all. But is the fact that, you know, a team that actually every single year for, I think, for the last 12 or 14 years has operated in the black, not in the red, but operated in the black with their home meets and that stuff. I think one year they've lost money and everything else. They have been a team that has, you know, been in the black. And I don't know how you cut a team like that in total only costs $2.2 million, which again, in only, but at the same time, your head football coach makes $8.3 million. Okay. And I understand football coaches have done an incredible job getting themselves up to the salaries that they do. Absolutely. No disrespect to Dabo Swinney, to anybody else on the podcast or that listen to this. If a football coach does, my apologies completely. But at the same time, how you financially can do that is beyond me, not even the finance side of it. If I'm not mistaken, I saw that's a statistic, and somebody can correct me if I'm wrong, but there's of the Olympic sports that Clemson has – sponsors as of today, okay, because again, paperwork still has to be finished and filed for Clemson for cross and track. There's 31 African-American athletes, okay. 21 of those are on the cross country and track and field teams. 21 of those, but Clemson comes out and says we want to go to a more diverse model of a campus, but you cut 21 kids, and of the remaining 10, and again, each sport is different, has a different demographic, 8 more are in soccer. So there's 3 kids on the rest of the remaining Olympic sports, and I'd have to look it up, that are not there. And it's like, so Clemson, what are you trying to do? What is the point of doing this kind of thing? So I wanted to throw it open to you guys and see what you think, see what your thoughts. I mean, I know we've talked about Minnesota. Let's give William and Mary a lot of credit again. Their women did an incredible job helping to bring that program back. That is awesome. And the rest of those sports are there too. But Vicky, gentlemen, I wanted to bring it out to you guys. Thoughts on Clemson?
Well, my initial thoughts, aside from just being appalled and also the feelings of sadness and loss for the student athletes and the coaches involved with that, I'm not an administrator. I don't oversee their budgets. But I think, Matt, you pointed out the fact that their programs have been in the black. You know, they've been bringing money in. Obviously, in comparison to the cost of some other sports, it's significantly less. One of the other things I always look at when I look at cross country, indoor track, and outdoor track is from a financial standpoint. And I don't know how many overall sport teams Clemson has, but you know, you have an awful big bang for your buck. You have 3 teams where a good portion of that team is on all 3 sport teams. So you're not, you know, reproducing costs for 3 separate, completely separate teams. So it becomes financially a, a pretty good way to have a lot of student athletes. And as you mentioned, the diversity aspect, certainly with track and field, we are among one of the more diverse sports in collegiate athletics. And it just seems to be taking away more and more opportunities for minorities to be able to get their college education and have the collegiate sports experience. And it's very disheartening to see university leadership that it seems to be blind to the fact that what these teams are bringing to the university. And I think, you know, certainly our CEO, Sam Seams, has pointed out many very contradictory statements coming out from Clemson. As you noted, they want to promote more diversity while you just, you know, eliminated all of these student athletes from your program, which more than likely would transfer to another program where they can have that opportunity. So that's kind of my thought. It's just very disheartening and very upsetting. And I wish I had the solution to avoid that, which I don't. I'm not smart enough for that. But I know we have some incredible minds around our coaching world that are putting together some great ideas.
We do. And just for the record right now, real quick, I just looked it up. Clemson has 9 women's sports and they have 8 men's sports.
Wow.
So you'd have to think if you went down to 5, you'd be adding one, maybe?
Yeah.
I don't know who you're adding, what you're doing. I really don't. Yeah. So
well, I think I was going to say at some point here, you're going to have to make the bed that you lay in. So the reason why so many of these sports, the reasons that they cite are primarily financial. I don't know that the Title IX thing necessarily holds up. I mean, the one sort of double-edged sword of having 3 sports and 1 staff and in one budget is that on one hand, you do cut those sports and don't really cut as much as you think you're going to because you've still got a women's program that uses the same facility and the same coaches and a lot of times and, you know, the shared budgets of travel and recruiting and this, that, and the other. You know, on the other hand, for every 1 kid that you cut, you're technically cutting 3 kids because they're counting 3 times. So in terms of banging for your buck, if you're going to cut, I can kind of see where that comes from. That said, you know, again, you can't have it both ways. So if you're citing these budgetary, we all know the reason why they're cutting sports like this is to be able to fund the sports that are very profitable at a higher level. So at some point you can't just do that without admitting that you're doing things with a profit in mind, right? Like this whole thing is happening with a profit in mind. And once we start admitting that we're doing things with a profit in mind, now all of a sudden you've got what we would by definition call professionals working for you in a sense, right? So on one hand, if you cut a program because you're trying to increase the budget and, you know, have more money for a profitable program, then all of a sudden those kids become, you know, the priority is to people that are making you profits, which sounds an awful lot to me like professional athletes. And so, you know, we're getting a pass in this COVID era for being able to say we've got these budget shortfalls, which is 100% true. But I just think that at some point that pass is going to go away. And all of a sudden, all this money that we're trying to save is, you know, they're going to have to start paying these. You can't just play both sides of the coin here and take what's good for you and on one hand and not, you know, answer for it on the other side. So, I mean, it's an awful thing. You know, the fact that there's so many opportunities cut for such a diverse group of athletes is just horrible. But I really do think this is all going to kind of come around and the reality of the situation is going to become pretty apparent pretty soon.
You know, it just kind of scares me. I mean, you actually, you know, have the exact same thoughts. You know, at Clemson, there's no way this is a money issue. You know, I mean, you have a budget, you know, I don't remember how many years ago that they were at like $75 million. And then, you know, a few years later, they're at $130 some million. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, you look at some of the, you know, the facilities they have within like their football program and stuff. I mean, it's just obnoxiously obscene, like just the things that they have. But I think the thing that scares me is, you know, you're starting to see, you know, a lot of these programs, you know, and we've seen it all, you know, the last 7-8 months, you know, they've dropped down and they've got to this number of, you know, 16. That's the minimum that everybody's, you know, they're getting to that. And it really is kind of concerning. It's like, well, when are they going to make that push? It's like, well, now we want to be down to 12 or 14. And then there's going to be another round of cuts where we're just kind of, you know, feeding the big giants of, you know, the footballs and the basketballs and, you know, to where, you know, how many opportunities are we really losing and stuff. And it's, you know, I hope something is done because I just see this being a snowball effect that, you know, who knows where it could end.
Well, one of the things I think is encouraging though, you know, I'm in the same kind of geographical region as Clemson and I recruit against them sometimes. And some of the athletes I see, one of the things I've noticed is some of the Clemson women's team is actually taking up the mantle and pushing out petitions to have coaches and other athletes and people sign in order to voice their opinion. And, you know, the hope is if they can organize similarly to what William and Mary did, maybe we can move this in the direction we're trying to move this.
That would be awesome. I haven't seen anything from the Clemson women coming out to do this, sign the petitions, but that would be something, I mean, unbelievably, that would be incredible. But there's no question about it. Since the 80s came up, like men's basketball and football, suspending has been proof. I mean, Clemson did just open something like a $55 million facility, something, not $55 million, if I'm not mistaken on this. I got the number wrong, but let me get this right. No, 142,000 square foot, $55 million training football facility, just for football. Which I think has got a lazy river, a barbershop, and a miniature golf.
A slide.
I want a slide.
Obnoxious.
Don't you want to slide?
That's much needed. That's needed. You need a slide.
No, it's just it's a bigger systemic issue within the NCAA. I mean, Dabo Sweeney and Matt, you kind of said, "Well, I apologize to any football coach." I don't apologize. I wouldn't apologize to any football coach. I mean, yeah, they're doing great. Good for them, but. Dabo Sweeney would be the fifth highest paid coach in the NFL. Okay. I don't feel bad for,
I didn't know that one.
For somebody like Dabo Sweeney. And if we're going to move, like kind of like what Mike said, if they're going to move that direction where you're going to pay your head football coach NFL type money, you're going to build NFL type facilities, well, then these players should be compensated. Maybe not like NFL type players, but the rubber's got to hit the road at some point, and there's got to be a reorganization of how football operates because it is now becoming a professional sport, and it's just you cannot have an amateur track and field program, amateur cross country program, in the same building as a professional football team. It just does not work. The divide is just far too great. And so, I mean, we can pound, you know, beat the tables and pound the walls and all those, you know, fun cliched statements. But at some point, the system has to be rewritten and we have to identify, the NCAA has to identify, are we a minor leagues for the NFL or are we truly about amateur athletics? Because quite frankly, we're not about amateur athletics anymore. Like that ship, I think, has sailed a long time ago, and we're trying to do something that is antiquated at this point.
Does it feel like if we keep going down this road with the way that, I mean, one thing I know we've talked about, not only the podcast, but behind the scenes and over a couple, you know, little adult beverages and that kind of stuff, is the fact of football and basketball, essentially football needs to break away from the NCAA, be governed by their own bodies and do what they need to do. But are we walking down the road that for example, we as a cross country and track and field, and we're just going to use there because we don't coach any other sports. We're walking down to be just come the European model. You know, where if you're not familiar with the European model, but now it's, you know, it's all coached by who you want to coach with. And you just go straight pro and you get to a club, you join a club and off you go. And then all of us are looking to be, well, do we be club coaches? Or do we go back to, do we try and
teach? No, I don't think so, because no. I think there's still a place for, you know, kind of the idea of a co-curricular activity to your education. I there's still value to that. In our system. And it's, I mean, personally, I think school presidents need to take their athletic departments back. You know, you've got these athletic departments that are so big that they're operating as their own LLCs. And so I think at some point a university president has to step in and take their athletics department back, because there is value to the co-curricular experiences that, you know, obviously, yeah, we coach track and field and cross country, so we know those experiences, but you know what, the softball teams, the baseball teams, the tennis teams, the golf teams, they have great experiences. You know, those kids have great experiences in those programs too. So there is value to it. Yep. This idea that we're going to have a club system, I mean, I guess it could work, but I mean, I don't know how it would work. It's such a foreign idea, you know, because you go through high school, right? You're going to go through the American high school system with your school teams, and we just like they're going to go to some random club at some university. I don't see how that would work very well.
You know, you brought up baseball, and it kind of makes me think, you know, you look at the major professional sports in, you know, our country, you know, basketball, football, and baseball. And it's like, you know, why isn't it, you know, baseball, like, you know, at the college level, what it is, you know, or not big like the basketballs or the footballs. And I think it has a lot to do with, you know, the minor league system that's in place in, you know, baseball. I mean, you know, adults, they can go into, you know, play in the minor leagues and stuff and try to work their way up to the majors. And I think at the collegiate level, you have obviously some really great players, but I don't think it's that driver of, you know, or feeder system to the professional major league system.
It's not. No. And you know, I think Major League Baseball, however they made their agreement with the collegiate system, where, you know, if you sign a scholarship, or if you accept a scholarship and you, I guess, enroll, you can't play professionally for 3 years. And so, you know, I think that saved the college game, obviously. And obviously I think just talking with our baseball coach at SLU, you know, they've done some things within their sport to add parity, with the kind of roster limits. So I think that has helped the college game, because probably in the last, I don't know. I mean, I've always kind of been a fan of college baseball. Obviously I played college baseball for a small time period.
I love that thing.
And so, you know, the College World Series has always kind of been a big deal, but the parity now at the college game is much greater than it's ever been because of some of the things they've done. But I think the reason it hasn't taken off like college football is because some of the best players, if you're a superstar blue chip recruit, I mean, I think you talk to baseball coaches, the blue chip recruits, they're always worried, is he going to sign, you know, with his school, or is he going to sign with the pro team? And so I do think it's something that's leveled the playing field a little bit.
John, you mentioned, you know, presidents taking back their, you know, athletic departments. And, you know, I'm kind of wondering if that's even, you know, a possibility anymore. You know, they've, you know, a lot of presidents, they tell athletic departments they want them to be, you know, self-sustaining. And I know you have some feelings on this. Is this something that's probably bigger than the president? Meaning, you know,
I see it's interesting because I think there are a lot of big universities that the athletics department is totally separate from the university at this point. They have to raise all their own funds to support all their students, their coaches, all that, through, you know, ticket sales, through gate receipts, through donations, all of that, corporate partnerships. And then there's universities like here at St. Louis University, I don't know the exact budget, but my guess is probably 95% subsidized by the university. I mean, yeah, we sell season tickets for basketball and some other sports. And obviously we raise money through our donors and Billiken Club and everything like that. But, so there's a divide, I think, within Division I of schools that are subsidized by their university, as you know, versus the schools that are self-sustaining. Where I get kind of, you know, and it's the Minnesota's, you know, the situation at the University of Minnesota really burns me, because they self-sabotaged, in my opinion. You know, you have an administration that, you know, comes in and looks at your women's sports and says, well, the cross-country roster and track and field roster are way too large. So they start to eliminate women's positions, and then they turn around and say, well, we got a Title IX issue, so we got to cut, you know, we got to cut men's sports. Well, no, you manipulated the gender equity. And absolutely, you know, when Title IX was written, I think it was 1971 or 1972, when that law was written, there was never the idea that you were going to eliminate women's opportunities. You know, the whole reason the law was written was to have women's equality, or at least start to move that direction. So to have administrators manipulate what I believe is a federal, I mean, I think that's a federal offense at some level. I don't know. I'm not a lawyer, so I don't know how to prove it, but that's got to be some sort of federal offense to manipulate that. And so I think that's where you have to get, you know, legislators involved, you know, political, you know, elected officials involved in this process, because you're starting to monkey with something that is beyond the scope of an athletics director, beyond the scope of a university president. And I would guarantee that if you know, the federal government got involved and told the University of Minnesota, you're not receiving federal money until you rectify this situation, all of a sudden that situation would be rectified very, very quickly.
100%. I mean, if I think we heard Gary Wilson talk a lot about that, making sure legislators were being known, and he was running up the food chain. He was talking to state reps. He was going to the papers. He was finding everybody to go ahead and do that, not just the track and field community. He was making sure everybody outside of it was hearing about it. And that's one of the biggest, I mean, I think that's what William & Mary did. The women did when they posted that letter saying, we are not going to compete. These athletes, which was what, 26 or 28 athletes, are not going to compete, which will throw off everything with the gender numbers in Title IX. And that will scare administrators. And that's exactly what it did, you know? Not to flip here a little bit, but let's go ahead and flip here a little bit. Talking about the women's rise in sports and somebody who has risen in sports, and especially into the position that she is in the Coaches Association and the director at Buffalo. Vicky, again, thank you for being here. And I'm glad you're able to jump in and join us in these conversations. But love to hear a little bit, because you and I have worked together on projects, and you've heard me rant and do stuff like that, and I've been on the executive committees with you, but I really have never dug into your background a little bit. But I know for a fact, to start out, you were a seven-time NCAA champion and 10-time All-American at SUNY Cortland, if I'm not mistaken, up there. A couple national titles with the cross-country and track team. So how do you go from SUNY and then work your way through to where you are now?
Well, first of all, thanks so much for having me here. I'm thrilled to be here. I'm very honored that you invited me on. I started at SUNY Cortland, not really as a runner, but went there for physical education. I wanted to teach phys ed. And I would say the best way to describe my running in high school was I dabbled. I ran, you know, few weeks in the fall for cross country, a few weeks in the spring for outdoor track, and that was it. My main love in high school was actually music, and I'm a violinist, and had I been good enough, I would have been a professional musician. But I wasn't good enough, and God bless the music teachers in the world. There's no way I could ever teach music. I'd have to wear earplugs. Like, how my teachers went through it, I don't know. Physical education is really what I went to Cortland for. And my parents thought it would be a good idea for me to meet the coach should I want to try to join the team as a freshman. Mm-hmm. And I really had never thought about running in college, and I wasn't very good in high school. So, but I did meet the coach, and this will give you a little bit of my very sheltered background. When my parents said to me as a high school senior, well, when we visit the school tomorrow, you're going to meet the coach and you're never going to believe his name. And I'm like, okay. And they're like, Jack Daniels. And I said, okay. And they look at me again. My mom goes, Jack Daniels. I said, oh my God, Mom, I'm not going to embarrass you and forget his name. I'll remember it. Jack Daniels, Mr. Daniels. Got it. Okay. And my parents looked at each other. Now I'm the youngest of three. I have two older brothers. Enough said of that. Wow, got nothing to worry about with this one. So that was my introduction to Jack Daniels. And I will say that obviously I was incredibly fortunate to go to a university where the most fantastic coach, in my opinion, was. And I am grateful to him to this day for everything that he's provided for me. So had my career at Cortland. As I kind of meandered through and stumbled through my first few years, did not run my freshman year. After a week, I left the team. I don't like the word quit for many reasons. So I'm just going to say I left the team. I couldn't, I'm like, this is over my head, you know? And the women were pretty good. I knew that they had gone to the national championship. And I was like, wow, you know, I'm trying to keep up with them on runs. I'm like, I'm going to get lost. I'm not going to know how to get back to my dorm. You know, I'm in this little town of Cortland, New York, and God only knows what could happen on the side road, you know, getting sheltered life. So I quit the team, and, you know, periodically throughout the fall, Jack would see me through our phys ed building, and he would stop me and he's like, hey, Mitchell, how are your classes going? How's music going? How's this going? And I'm just like, how does this guy even know who I am? Like, I'm the one that was there for a week and left. And that right there tells the character of Jack that and one of the main reasons I went into coaching was his influence on me and his care for the individual versus care for the performance of the individual. And to me, my philosophy of coaching is centered around family and development. And from that, performance will come. And I think I really took a great deal of that from how Jack approached things. So I went through my 4 years, obviously ended up kind of growing into running, and had some great opportunities with our team, with Jack, and had some nice competition experiences. And then I went out to graduate school down at UNC Greensboro. And there was a gentleman there doing a lot of research in running economy. And by the way, finishing my 4-year degree of physical education with the music minor, I realized in my student teaching, oh, I'm not really sure I want to teach. And, you know, I'm a senior going, oh boy, both my parents were educators. So, you know, it's like, how do I tell my parents I don't want to do this? You know, that's the environment I grew up in. And I ended up talking with Jack, and he's like, well, that's easy. You'll go on to get your master's in exercise physiology, and you're going to go to Greensboro because there's a guy named there, Dr. Morgan, he's doing research in running economy, and that's what you're going to study. I said, simple enough. Wow. So I applied. Fortunately, I was accepted. You know, it's like all my eggs in the basket. And there also happened to be this nice little group of guys that were in master's and PhD programs that were runners. So I got down there, they took me under their wing. So the running part continued to develop, and I paid for a lot of my school by running probably too many road races. Had a fantastic education, wonderful experience, graduated and moved back to Buffalo with the premise and great discussions with my parents to say, I want to take 1 year and just see what I can do with running. Cause I was feeling like I was just starting to scratch the surface. And my parents were agreeable. I told them I was going to get a part-time job, pay them rent, and see what I could do. Meantime, one of my brothers that's just about 2 years older than me was teaching at a Catholic girls' school in Buffalo. And he was in math and physics. He also actually graduated from Cortland. And he said, hey, you know, we have a cross-country team. Do you want to like coach? It doesn't pay. It's just volunteer. But he had been coaching it. I use the term coaching. He'd been like moderating it. It was probably a better description. And my brother's incredibly fit, like super knowledgeable with general fitness, but definitely not like coach material. Anyhow, so he had been with their team, and I'm like, wow, yeah, that'd be great. And my parents had always brought me up that if there's an opportunity to give back, you do that. So I'm like, volunteer coaching, what could be better to get into that? And I went in to meet the principal, Sister Mary Kathleen, and, you know, I brought my resume, brought everything. I'm all dressed up for this volunteer coach interview. And she's looking through my stuff. So Victoria, by the way, the only person in the world that can call me Victoria is my mother. So now Sister Mary Kathleen is calling me Victoria, but you can't say anything to like a sister, right? So
nope, not at all.
Yes. You know, and she's like, all right, I see you have your bachelor's degree in education. I said, yes, physical education. It's great. I said, I have my master's too in exercise physiology. And she said, Well, that's great. Well, let me tell you, so this is going to be your teaching schedule this fall. And in physical education, your class schedules will look like this. And I said, oh, I'm sorry, Sister Mary Kathleen. I thought I was here to talk to you about volunteer coaching for cross country. She goes, well, we can talk about that too, but we need a phys ed teacher. So this is going to be your teacher.
You got hired.
I'm just like, what is happening?
Wow.
I just really didn't know what to make of this. And I said, I'd really like to coach. I don't think I want to teach. She goes, well, you take this and think about it and I'll call you in 2 days. So I go home and I was living with my parents because I just finished grad school. I've been home for 2 weeks. Yep. I get home and I'm like, I think I was just offered a teaching job. My mother's like, what? I go, do I say no? I mean, like, what do I do? And so I said, yes. Best thing is a fabulous 5 years. Now, I will tell you, I was teaching full-time coaching. I started their track and field program at a school that had about 222 girls. Mm-hmm. And I had about 45 of them on my track team. So we ended up winning league championship each year. And my pay, typical to a Catholic school, you know, it was about $13,500 for full-time coaching. But I was able to afford that because I was running, you know, and just for every opportunity that I had during that period. So that was really my introduction to be able to really get into coaching at a very small Catholic girls' school. And I knew coaching is ultimately where I wanted to go. So I started applying for college positions, and is probably characteristic to most, you don't have college coaching experience. And so, you know, here I am. I'm like, well, I understand I don't have college coaching experience because no one will give me the opportunity. So after I got past that, former assistant coach at Cortland State, Steve Lucido, originally he was from Kansas City, Missouri. Steve called me up. He was at the time an NAIA school, William Jewell College. Now they're Division II. Mm-hmm. Said, hey, you know, I'm hiring a coach for distance, and it's a part-time position, or full-time position, part coaching, part teaching. And I've already talked to Jack about this, and we can combine it with your running and, you know, get some coaching experience. I was like, wow, this is unbelievable. So I went out and interviewed, and I accepted the position and moved out to Kansas City, Missouri. I should have prefaced that by saying I'm a homebody. I'm from Buffalo, New York. And the furthest away I had ever been was Greensboro, North Carolina. And that my first, I'm going to say semester and a half, I think I cried every day because I was homesick. So that gives you an idea that I'm not really good at faraway places. I moved to Kansas City, and fabulous school. Love Steve Lucido. He's just such a wonderful man. Great coach, great mentor. But I was also, you know, half a country away from home. And I got to about April of that year. And I remember talking to my mother, and my father was teaching still full time. And I told my mom, I said, so listen, I'm going to come home for a couple of weeks this summer. I can stay at home, right? And she's like, of course. I go, how long can I stay there? Like, you know, a few weeks, a month. She goes, yeah, how long do you need it for? I said, I'm not really sure, but I'm not going to come back to this job this fall. And I assure you, I will find a job. I just don't know where, as long as I have a roof and a bed at your house. And I don't tell Dad, you know, that's the last thing. And I wanted my dad.
Don't do that. Don't do it.
Don't tell Dad. And ironically, probably 3 or 4 weeks later, Jack at Cortland called me to say that they were starting, they were going to kind of switch up the structure of the program to have a men's and women's coach. And he said, you need to apply. And I said, absolutely. Here's my resume. And literally a week later, the former head coach at the University of Buffalo called me. And I said, hey, I'm hiring a full-time distance coach. I'd like you to apply. And I said, I'd love to apply. So in one weekend in June, I flew out to Albany, raced Fraunhofer's Run for Women. Then I went to an interview at Buffalo, an interview at Cortland, and flew back to Kansas City. And I ended up accepting the position at the University of Buffalo. and incredibly grateful for the opportunities that I've been given. So, you know, 22 years later, here I am. And I would say, as you can kind of tell from one position to the next, I feel like, and this happens, you know, with racing too, you're in the right place at the right time and the right people are there to help you. And again, it kind of goes back to much of why I'm in coaching is the opportunity to be able to help young adults be able to develop in all our areas of their life. As I've been given so many opportunities in our sport for competitive opportunities, but also in the world of coaching, to be able to get to University at Buffalo, to be a head coach, and to be able to do that in my hometown. Like, who gets a head coaching position at a Division I university in their hometown? And to me, as I've mentioned, Buffalo is very important to me, not just the city, but obviously my family's there. So that is a huge thing for me, and ever so grateful for the opportunities that I've been given.
I love that. I love that. I love the passion about it that you talk about. Because I think one thing that's forgotten with a lot of coaches, young coaches that get into it, maybe it's because I'm getting a little older right now, but is still the fact that a lot of them forget your ass needs to pay your dues before you get in. You need to go through some of the trials and tribulations, move a full country away, you know, places you've never been. Even if you are run straight back home, you need to do those kind of things to experience it, to get the different opportunities that you have. Because again, as you said, there's the right opportunities to get put at you. You take, run with them, use them, and help them go. But kids need to learn. This is something that it's tough. No questions about that. But you got to get out of your comfort zone.
You do. You do. And for me, that was the I'm a relatively introverted, shy person. Moving across country was like life altering, but also that push and that risk that I had to take in personal development. And that very similar, I will liken it to, you know, when you're in a race or a competition, there's the critical point, the moment of decision. You either commit to it or you don't. If you commit to it, something good's going to happen. And that for me to kind of say, you know what, I know this is what I want to do with my career. And the running thing is fun, and brought incredible experiences. And I was fully supported when I moved to Kansas City and with Steve Lucido to continue running and training while I was there. But I also knew ultimately, you know, that wasn't going to last forever. So I pretty much knew taking the position at Buffalo, I'd probably be, you know, scaling back on any type of my own personal running, which was totally fine. At that point, you know, I was 29 and, you know, I was like, you know, I'm ready to really dive into this coaching thing. And the one thing that I loved at William Jewell is I got to teach exercise physiology and biomechanics, and I love teaching. And of course, as coaches, I think that's what we do every single day. But I love the academia side of things.
A little bit of violinist in you there too. You know, there's the musician side of it and doing the academia side. You keep hinting at the running that you were doing in the running and you went to do in Kansas City and kept going with that kind of stuff. Am I correct? You made five U.S. national teams in the different events, something along those lines.
Yes. Again, I happen to be at the right place at the right time with the right people in my corner. You know, Karen McGlatchy at USA track and field, when she was a women's LDR, wonderful woman. Again, another wonderful mentor. It gave me a lot of opportunities. And I kind of look back a lot of times and go like, not really sure how I got to be the lucky one. And it's kind of funny, like Jack always talked about, you know, you can have talent and ability and passion and desire and all that stuff, but there's always some luck involved. And I am a believer in that. I was on a few Ekinen teams. My first U.S. team was the World University Games. And the joke with my family was I finally made my first U.S. team. And my first international competition was in Buffalo, New York for the World University Games in 1993.
Fittingly.
Yes, yes. So the, like the 75 people in the stands for the women's 10,000, which I ran with Lori Hennes, who you know, beat my butt in that race. Those 75 people, I think 74 of them were my friends and family members. You know, maybe a coach from another team happened to come out to watch it. But that was my first experience on a U.S. team.
Yeah. Home field advantage on a world stage.
I'll tell you, you know what? It's actually a really beautiful stadium. And I know, unfortunately, I was not here in 98 to be at the NCAA championships. I've only heard four stories of snow. But until this last, until the outdoor 2019, the NCAA 4x1 record was still holding from that meet in 1998 in the snow. I don't know how that was possible.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And then Leroy Brell's teams went and beat it. But, you know, it, great facility when there's not snow.
But you guys have done incredible things with the snow, no matter what it was, especially with the last year cross country. We won't dive into that. That thought you did a tremendous job with that for the record, by the way. One of the biggest things, I know you've been a big with women in coaching and that kind of stuff. You did what is the Buffalo chapter of Girls on the Run as well too. Am I correct on this?
Yes. I was a board member for, I think, 6 years, and then my terms expired, my time expired, but I've been the race director for the Girls on the Run for the 10 years of its existence. Actually, this past June was our 10th year anniversary, which was canceled due to COVID. But I don't have all the stats of how many young girls from the Western New York area we've had go through the program, but on average, our spring program's about 1,500 girls from the local area. And then fall program, which is a little bit smaller, averages around, say about 700 or so girls. So it's a phenomenal program. And I'm getting to the point now, and I remember when I was calling a recruit and it was the first time I heard them say, well, I got started with running in Girls on the Run. I was like, yes, that's awesome. And I said, you know, I was your race director for that. And so, you know,
kind of,
but yeah, that's, again, you look at young girls in that that age group of third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth grade that the program covers, and in a very vulnerable stage of their life to be taught communication and leadership and empowerment of being a young girl growing up, and important qualities, not all the crap that we see on social media. I am ever so grateful that social media didn't exist when I was growing up. I probably would have been a disaster. I've never been on Strava, but you know, if something like that existed when I was training, I probably would have been like a geek and totally psyched myself out of everything. I think less sometimes is better.
No, I 100% could agree with you. I mean, I remember being one of the first years of, like, I think my junior or senior year in high school was when Diastat became a bigger thing. And a lot of us, I think, on this can know what Diastat was. Mm-hmm. An incredible job for the sport. There's no questions about it. Helped move the sport forward. But man, I remember being like, wow, Diastat, like I can learn things. And even then when I got done, I went to college, I had no idea who my teammates were. They're like, we all know who you are. And I was like, wait a minute, how? Like Diastat? I was like, you look me up on Diastat. You've got to be kidding me. All right, that's how this works. But that's neither here nor there. So that's the incredible thing. But so the you're in the now you're in your role as it is right now, as the final month, we've seen you do jumping jacks and flips and all that kind of stuff. You've probably run a little trampoline quietly in your shoes because you're so excited with it. I've been an executive member with you for the last 2 years, 3 years now, and you've done an incredible job with it. But out of curiosity, and I ask this not because I don't know, but because honestly, I don't know. I've been on this for 9 years, the committee. Are you the first cross-country female president of that side? Because I know we have the track side and the cross-country side. And I was doing some research on it. I think you might be the first one.
I have to be honest, I actually do not know. I remember talking with Sue Parks at Eastern Michigan several years ago. She had been vice president. And that was when who was president? Michigan State, Michigan State
head coach. Trent?
Thank you. Walt was, I'm pretty sure, was the president at that time, and Sue was vice president, in the position to move into the president position. And then she switched jobs from Ball State to Eastern Michigan, and she stepped down from her role. And so she was on that pathway. I know in my time of being involved with the executive committee, it's been men. So I know I'm the first one in probably 15 years. Prior to that, I have to be honest, I actually don't know. Obviously we've had a number on the track and field side, but it's been an experience.
Did you, when you became president, did you set out to, was there something you set out to accomplish? Or was more, I want to steer this, want to keep the ship afloat, or was there any goals that you had set out?
Survival, grow thick skin, which happened in the first convention.
That had been the first week, really.
Yeah. That I remember going into that first convention, you know, I was somewhat nervous, but thank God for the people like Shannon Wright. Yep. But that was an eye-opening experience. And, you know, last year I went into convention with a set of armor ready for everything that was going to be thrown at me by the coaching body. But no, I think for me, when the opportunity came and I was asked if I would be interested in being considered for second vice president, because we had the second vice president, blah, blah, blah. I was overwhelmed and thought, oh my God, I'm not qualified for that. And then I stepped back and I thought a lot, and I'm like, you know what? You need to step outside your comfort zone. And again, I'm not a social person. I'm not one that likes to go, you know, all of the incredible food they serve us at convention. I'm like, okay, let me sit at a little table, eat, and then go hide. Like, I'm not going to go out and have some drinks and hang out with people. It's just not my personality and style. So I wanted to put myself in a position that was going to force me to grow professionally. And, we've had some incredible leaders prior to me, and we're going to have incredible leaders after me that I think have done great things for our sport. And being able to watch Dave Smith in the role, Sean Cleary in the role, Barry Hartwick, and everyone before that, you know, I watched a lot of people do some great things. At the time that I was moving into president, I would say the biggest thing that was being discussed was qualification for the championships and the ongoing controversy of who is saying we have to qualify, you know, the great who's behind this. And I think my ultimate thought was, man, if we can have this resolved in 3 years, this is going to be great. And certainly at this point, I don't think there's any question that the NCAA Sport Committee has been charged to come up with a qualifying system that is not currently what we use. So I think that's coming. And for me, the biggest thing is we need to have something that is going to make our sport better. We don't want to do something that's going to hinder our sport's development. So if I can be in a position that somehow I'm helping our sport grow, and provide better opportunities for the student athletes and for the coaches, that would be a wonderful thing to accomplish. I don't know how you can define and qualify that in this role. I don't have like, oh, here's the checklist of things that I wanted to be able to do. I look back and still see like a blur for the last, you know, 34 months of this position and think like, wow, I feel like I've been, 10 feet under trying to like hang on for dear life.
It's something special. It's incredible. We've sat in those meetings before and heard those things go back and forth in the conversations. Sometimes I'm not sure what exactly we walk out and I'm not exactly sure what we actually talked about, but we did something. Mm-hmm. I think we did something. I'm not sure what it is. I think what was I going to go with here? I had an idea.
Matt, I'll jump in. I have a question for you. I know we've had a few guests on in the past, and we've asked this question. Where would you like to see the sport maybe 5 years from now? If you could, you know, project out, what would you like to see the sport?
Preferably more programs than less programs than we have right now. That would be number one. To be honest, that's a fantastic question. And I don't know that I've actually taken a step back to say, this would be ideal. What I would like to see is, you know, our sport be cross country and track and field, be recognized as a valuable part of our students' collegiate career, number one. Number two, for people to understand, like, student athletes that we're graduating, number one, mostly the Olympians that we're going to see at the track and field side of things are coming from Division I programs, right? So we can certainly say there's a great deal of development there. But I think that our sport in particular with cross country, we're developing some unbelievable people for the world. And I'm one of those very kind of holistic people and look at what value does sport bring to our lives. And that's probably part of my Division III upbringing is, you know, we very much that focus of academics and athletics. But I look at some of the students that we've graduated from the University of Buffalo and the unbelievable things that they're doing now and where they came from, you know, inner city, parents in jail, got an opportunity to go to college on a scholarship, and now they're a doctor. You know, to me, like, that's pretty dang fantastic. So I guess when I look at it more as like, how is this helping our students succeed? And again, it's such a holistic view, and it's not really answering your question.
But I think that's a very powerful view. I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head a little bit there with, like, the holistic approach. You look at it and you say, you know, some people have been given this opportunity and this is what they've done with it. And, you know, you're a great example because you've been 22 years in the same place. So you've been able to see people come through and go do these amazing things. So, you know, I think a lot of times we get, and maybe we're still doing it, get bogged down in the minutiae of, like, what does the sport look like? But in reality, it's, you know, what opportunities does it give people?
Right. And reality is, you know, we already discussed football and the enormous amount of money that is in that, verging on professional level at the collegiate level. For the most part, I think it would be a correct statement that most track and field student athletes are not going to be at that financial level of gain. So we're really looking at what part does this play in their life. And again, I had some really amazing opportunities to be able to compete post-collegiately. I'm very grateful for that. And I think, like, how that enhanced what I do now, who I am now, and the roles that those played. And to me, it's just kind of how it fits into each person's growth and development.
You know, I love what you're saying. And I have my Allegheny College t-shirt on here tonight, which is right down the road in Meadville. You're probably familiar.
I knew so
many people. Yeah, I knew a ton of people from Western New York on the team and in school and everything else. But coming from that D3 background and now at the Division I level, you know, I think that might be something. I love what you're saying, that might be something that we're missing in this sale of these track and cross country programs where, you know, if you're, and I don't want to take anything away from these major sports, but the main goal for so many of those kids is to be a professional athlete, whereas that's the main goal of almost nobody that we coach. I mean, and no matter whether you're at a big time Power 5 school or at a small Division I school, but we all have stories of kids who would have never even had the opportunity to go to college if it weren't for their athletic ability. and the fact that they got, you know, maybe some money to go there. And these kids were going to be a drain on society, quite frankly, because that's what they came from, right? Like you said, you've got parents in jail. You've got maybe one or no parents at home. You barely get out of high school, even from an academic standpoint, because it's a bad situation. You get to college because you're an athlete. You're not going to become a professional athlete, but how, I mean, we can all list tons of kids that barely got out of school that come to college, they get great grades, they go on to be productive members of society, right? And without that athletic opportunity, they're just back at home doing the stuff that everybody else did, you know? Right. And those types of stories, I feel like we ought to prop up more so than these super success stories of our, and not to say that football and basketball players don't do that same thing, but that's kind of the only thing we got. Absolutely. You know, and it's such a huge thing. And I love to hear you kind of say that and value that. And maybe, and again, I'll say maybe it is that D3 background, because I get it. And I've been there too, you know, that's a big sell. You know, you've got this diverse group of people that turn their life around because of opportunities that they have to do these sorts of things. And they're just incredible, you know?
Yeah. So talking about some backgrounds and things, how do we get, you know, one thing we talked a little bit about it, women in coaching, how do we get more women into the profession? I think it's a question we've all talked about, thought about, and all that kind of stuff. What would you be the ideas on it? Because I know that we have seen a growth, and sometimes you get a person, and one thing I hate is you get an incredible female, it's either way, but a lot of times you see this on the women's side as well too. You get an incredible female, they do a great job for 3 years, they get offered a job at, I don't know, let's just say at Indiana. I'm just sorry, I'm going to use a school here for a quick thing. First top of my head.
Sure.
And, you know, in 2 years, they've been running to the ground. They do everything, and then they quit.
Yes. And
it's like, okay, how do you keep a female to stay in the job, especially for now what you've done for 22 years at a school? But it's hard. It's really hard. How do you get them in? How do you keep them?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I know you've talked to Rhonda Riley before, and the mentorship program that she's been very instrumental
in. Incredible job there.
Our association. And this is my second year working as a mentor, and that's been an incredible experience as well. I remember among my first conventions that I went to, and, you know, it wasn't every year at that point that they had like a female development section, but I remember going in the first year, and I, there might have been 30 women coaches. And looking around, and I'm like, not a lot of people here. And, you know, I was probably 31 or 32 going, well, I'm really not that young in this group. And now I look around and go, first of all, it's great to see so many more women at our convention.
Oh, absolutely.
But I'm also one of the older coaches at 51. And I have talked a lot with Beth Sullivan, who's been an incredible mentor to me. And, you know, for me, I look at, you see some of these young women that come in and that are incredible rock stars, you know, like, oh my God, they're gonna do awesome things. And ultimately it comes down to, I think a lot of times, they have to choose, or we as women have to choose between our profession and having a family, right? There are, as we know, many very successful female coaches who are married with children, and God bless them. I can tell you, you know, as a single female, every guy I have dated has been like, what do you mean you're traveling again this weekend? And what do you mean you have to work tonight? I'm like, dude, I'm a coach. When am I going to call high school kids? Of course, they're in COVID right now. I can call them in the middle. That's been fabulous. But yeah, you know, I mean, it's a challenging thing. And to me, I view it very much as I do as being a student athlete. A lot of people say, like, oh my gosh, you make so many sacrifices. No, you don't. If it's something that you're passionate about and something that you love, it's your lifestyle to me. And that's a huge difference versus saying I'm making sacrifices for this. If you're making sacrifices, you're like, oh, that's drudgery. You know, this is not anything enjoyable. You know, Jack always had a saying, if you're looking forward to working out, you're in danger of success. And to me, it just kind of tells you, like, Yeah, those are the people you want that are excited to work hard, that are excited to dive in. And perhaps on my end, I am very focused and driven to the point that, again, most people say, well, you know, you're going to be home on Sunday. Maybe we could go out. I'm like, oh no. I need to catch up on paperwork, you know, and I got to get in my own run and I got to do this. So you know, maybe next month, you know, and that's, you know, a knock against me. But I think for a lot of people, it becomes very challenging to be able to balance that. And the ones that have done it successfully, from what they've told me, is they just have the most unbelievable spouse. I talked to our women's head basketball coach, Coach Jack, phenomenal woman. And, you know, she's married, her son's a phenomenal basketball player, all this other stuff. But she always tells me I have the best husband in the world. And that I think is one of the keys, is you find that right balance of relationships to keep women in coaching, number one. Number two, I think oftentimes as women, we have to support women. And I think there's sometimes this feeling of, I don't want to ask for help because it would be showing that I'm weak. And I think there's this, I have to outwork every single other person to prove my worth. And certainly that's a work ethic that I'm going to take in everything that I do. At the same time, I'm stepping back and realizing, okay, I'm competent at this, and I'm going to help support my other female coaching peers versus saying I have to beat them or I have to work against them. Just as within, I think men do this much better where they support each other, and they, you know, if another guy has a athlete that has a great performance, like they're the first to go up and congratulate them, right? And I think that's something that is growing in women's coaching, but I think it's a challenge, particularly for women that do want to be able to have children, have a husband, and, you know, we travel a lot. Of course, this would be a perfect time to be, you know, get pregnant and have kids, you know, during COVID because we're not traveling. Oh my God, I thought about that 9 months ago. What have I done? Damn, lost my opportunity.
Not over yet.
All right. Sorry, I got to go, guys. Bye.
I know, apparently, if anybody saw the tweet, apparently they're going to be recruiting dead period till April 1st or at least the 14th, something along those lines.
Oh, really? Yeah, I haven't seen that one yet.
That one did just come out. I can't remember. I think it was either on the D1 ticker or somebody else put it out. I can't remember who it were. I was like, good night. So maybe we got 4 more months. You never know what happens with things.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I got some time then. Excellent. Yeah. And, you know, my clock's ticking too at 51. I don't know how much longer I have to do this baby thing. So I don't want any of those, by the way.
Appreciate the clarification.
I appreciate all the other people in the world keeping population up. It's not happening for me.
So what, if you had another, you know, you talked about Jack Daniels being a big influence on you and what you've done, and not just maybe the drink, but also especially the philosopher, of course. So I've actually know the training. I mean, heck, I think we've all, if you're a distance coach, you've got Jack Daniels volume 1 and 2 sitting on your shelf. And no question, he's done an incredible job. Was there another somebody else that you talked about? There's the books right there. Absolutely. Is there another coach that you took a couple points from, whether it be training wise or whether it be in your quotes?
Gosh, you know, there's in the world of coaching, absolutely. And I think whether it's learning from people in terms of science and education, certainly there's some incredible coaches out there like Joe Vigil, you know, and many similar overlapping things to Jack. But that would be another big one that, you know, anytime I have the opportunity to have attended a lecture that he's given, I will jump at it because he's just brilliant. But I think there's a lot of coaches that are still in the NCAA level that have been great influences, and not so much, I would say, on coaching, well, strategies, you know, development of like, okay, best way to develop your VO2 max system. Well, I'm a freaking physiologist. I know how to do that, but best way to communicate to your student athletes, right? I'm communicating to a very diverse group. And, you know, my first 11 years at UB, no, 13 years, 10 years, 11 years. I don't know, my first lot of years at UB, I coached all the men distance runners. And then I was able to hire a full-time assistant coach. And, you know, Todd Witzleben's done a great job coaching our men and very fortunate to have that. But boy, that opened my eyes of being able to have, wow, I have so much more time to be able to focus in on the women and really get more detailed with them. And I valued that. So I think the communication style also in coaching women, I think we have so many different aspects to look at that, and same thing with guys. I mean, there's 100 different ways to skin a cat, but ultimately being able to help each individual. And a lot of times, it doesn't matter how great of a coach I am, you have to have buy-in from the student athletes, right? So, I mean, I could give them everything that, you know, makes perfect logical sense from the physiological standpoint, yet it doesn't make sense to that individual. And no matter what I say, it doesn't make sense. If I get some better sense of what helps them, mm-hmm. that is a big part of it. So I think one of the things that I've really learned, and this is from other coaches, is you got to listen to your student athletes, right? It's not a one-way street. I love feedback from my athletes. And I want to take that or feedback from another coach and take it as an opportunity to learn versus being defensive about it. And I would certainly say in my first 3, 4, 5 years of coaching, I had a much more, I felt insulted if someone offered some piece of advice to me. I'm like, well, am I not smart enough? Am I doing this wrong? You know, are they running the wrong way? Isn't it supposed to be right foot, left foot? You know, you really question everything. But so from that standpoint, I would say probably like every coach in the NCAA that I've ever had an opportunity to talk with, a huge influencer on my life outside of my parents and outside of Jack, honestly, was my high school orchestra teacher. And one of the best things that I learned from her was work ethic. And I think that comes with music, just as it does with athletics. But she happened to be the orchestra teacher when I was in elementary school. And I remember her telling me, you know, Vicki, if you want to make my high school orchestra, and at that time she was split part-time to elementary, part-time at the high school. If you want to make my high school orchestra, you're going to have to practice an awful lot. And I was like, okay, so I did, and I did, and I did, and I did. And, you know, I'm thankful for her telling me you need to do that. And I think the other element is, and I talk to my students about this all the time, the difference between going through the motions versus being disciplined with what you're doing, right? So there's no point in practicing if you're not practicing with discipline and focus to attention to the right details, right? And I use the example of, you know, Johnny's out on the baseball field and the coach yells as he's staring up at the sky, Johnny, you got to focus. Well, great, but you haven't told Johnny what to focus on, right? So I think that such an important element, especially with the youth that we have now that we're coaching, is really helping them understand correct focus and correct discipline and how to apply that. Because they haven't necessarily grown up in that environment of learning how to do it on their own. They've been catered to.
True.
I have a twofold question for you. First, what's your favorite genre of music? And second, how has music maybe impacted the way you coach?
Mm.
Okay.
Baroque music is my favorite. And I would love to live in the Baroque era if there were modern amenities, because I just think it's the greatest music. Period instruments, love it. Okay, so that answered that question. And what has there? Oh gosh, discipline, discipline, discipline. So, as you might guess, I listen. I'll generalize and say classical music quite a bit. But by classical, I mean that in a whole, like, you know, romantic, impressionistic, baroque, renaissance, all of that together, right? Hard to explain what that brings to my coaching, other than probably a little bit of sanity.
There you go. Okay. I could follow that.
Yeah.
You still play?
I do. I'm a closet player these days. I play for myself. Mm-hmm. I played in several of my college roommates' weddings. Actually, a couple of years ago, played in my cousin's wedding. But I really don't do anything with groups formally. Once in a while, if I get together with a friend, we might like jam for a little bit, but nothing formal. And I don't practice. So like, whereas I practice all the way through school, graduate school. In fact, when I was living in Kansas City, their William Jules College Orchestra was a semi-pro orchestra. And I auditioned and was able to play in that. As an amateur, I didn't get paid for that. Again, I'm not that good. But from that point, I mean, I practiced a lot. As I got a little bit more into running, that balance shifted, right? So running, you know, started to do more than 15 miles a week, which is probably what I maxed out in high school. And practicing 2 or 3 hours a day, definitely that balance shifted a lot.
For sure.
Absolutely love it. That's an incredible thing to be able to be a violinist, a closet violinist, and then turn around at the same time and have, you know, so many different people asking you to play in the weddings and play for them, or just, oh, you know, shucks, we'll just go ahead and jam. I don't practice, but I just jam. Like, you might not, you know, be doing some things for the quarantine, but you might as well keep going ahead and playing more violin and rocking out a little bit and that kind of stuff, you know, having some fun.
Music is one of the most wonderful things, and you know, whatever you like to listen to, whether it's pop, it's rap, whatever. I have a harder time getting really into like rap, but in a guy I dated once called it that music stuff that you listen to without words. Without words. I said, yes, okay, got it. To me, it transports me. And there's many, many modern, more pop artists that their music will just transport me to a very fabulous place. And I can't really describe it. But I would imagine that if I drank, maybe that's the experience that people have transported to a fabulous place. For me, I can listen to music and just be in this really wonderful experience. Yeah. The best way to describe it. I can't explain it otherwise.
No, that's awesome. That honestly, it is an incredible thing to do. And one thing that we talk a lot about on this show, on this podcast, is to make sure you're finding an outlet outside of, you know, make sure you're kind of doing that kind of stuff, because we do get bogged down with the paperwork, the recruiting calls, the high school calls. Especially if you have two genders, then you've got to figure out and split calls on the weeks, and hopefully you can find a day to actually have it yourself. Mm-hmm. A significant other, hopefully you have a day to at least hang out with them, with that person, because there is so much else that you have to do. And now it's, you know, it's easier, but at the same time, it's easier to get more distracted, as you talked about as well. Vicky, it's been an incredible conversation with you. We've covered a ton. And to be honest with you, I covered it and I would have done it again and again. That is a great conversation. So thank you for being with us tonight.
Thank you so much. Again, I'm honored that you asked me to be on this podcast. Love what you guys are doing. And thank you for the opportunity.
No, absolutely. Thank you.
Thanks for coming on.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And ladies and gentlemen, we thank you as well, as always, for spending time out of your day, your morning, your afternoon, your evening, whatever the case might be, and joining and pulling a chair up to the table and joining the meeting of the Unknowing Minds. It's been an incredible journey with us today. Again, thank you to Vicky. Thank you for letting us be a part of your week. We appreciate you making us one of the running podcasts in the country. We continue and strive to do better each week. If you found some value in tonight's podcast or any of the episodes that we've been blessed and enabled enough to do, please go ahead, like us, leave a review on iTunes, share it with your friends and family. Say, hey, you got to check this out. These guys are trying to do some incredible things, and we really are. But until we pull a chair up next week to the table, look forward to talking to you then. Thanks, everybody.